next, we have job openings in our video news production fellowship and our internship program. Go to democracynow.org. I'm headed to Washington, D.C., part of our 100-city tour. I'll be at the Plymouth Congregational Church in Washington, D.C. tonight at 6:30. Then Saturday, it's on to Portland, Maine. Then in the evening in Bangor on Saturday. On Sunday, I'll be at College of the Atlantic in Bar Harbor at 11 in the morning. And then we're on to Chicago on Monday and Tuesday and Toronto at the end of the week. Check democracynow.org for details. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Portland, the time is 4:59 p.m. and coming up next is your KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Friends of Noise launch party on Sunday, May 22nd at 5:30 at Los Prados Event Hall in St. John's. Friends of Noise is a new Portland-based nonprofit sponsoring all-ages shows while working towards a brick-and-mortar space for youth to learn about the music industry. The kickoff event will feature performances by the Doo Doo Funk All-Stars, Neo Geo, Drex Porter, and Gem Dynasty. Again, that's the Friends of Noise all-ages launch party, Sunday, May 22nd, with doors opening at 5:30 p.m., the show starting at 6:30 p.m., at Los Prados Event Hall, 10105 North Lombard Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to be a founding sponsor of the Waterfront Blues Festival. The 29th annual festival takes place this year from July 1st through 4th and includes performers like the Tedeschi Truck Band, Jimmy Vaughn and the Tilt-A-Whirl Band, Samantha Fish, and many, many more. Festival passes are on sale at early bird prices until May 31st. More information about the festival performers, the options for passes, and other information can be found at kboo.fm/WBF2016.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Seattle Theater Group presenting An Astrophysicist Goes to the Movies, two evenings with Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson, September 19th and 20th at the Keller Auditorium. Tickets for Neil deGrasse Tyson this September are on sale now, and more information is available at portland5.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the latest in the ongoing Burgerville workers' efforts to unionize.
The Audubon Society of Portland is holding a protest against the government killing of cormorants.
And Methodists hold their world conference in Portland and are confronted with ministers pushing the issue of LGBT acceptance.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, May 13th, 2016. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Lisa Loving. Yesterday, Burgerville workers and community supporters from a wide array of local organizations visited corporate headquarters to deliver a letter. KBOO reporter Kanan Schlesinger has the story.
On Tuesday, April 26th, workers of iconic Portland-based fast food franchise Burgerville made a surprise visit to corporate headquarters to announce that they had formed a union. In addition to asserting their right to organize by forming the Burgerville Workers Union, workers at Burgerville also demanded, among other things, a $5 an hour raise, a safer and healthier workspace, and paid maternity leave. They held a rally earlier that day at the Clinton Street Theater to announce they're going public. For over a week, the Burgerville Workers Union heard nothing from corporate. Then, just last Friday, every employee was issued a letter along with their paycheck. The letter included heavily biased language, admonishing their workers of several dangers of joining a union. According to worker and organizer Lewis Brennan, many of the contents within this letter were untrue and, quote, looked like they had Googled union busting and copied and pasted the first thing they found. In response, the Burgerville Workers Union lead organizers compiled a simple infographic that refuted each untrue or inaccurate item in the letter that corporate used to scare its employees away from union membership. They distributed this letter to every Burgerville shop so that all workers, unionized or not, could see. In addition, Burgerville workers in a wide swath of community made a delegation to corporate headquarters again, this time in larger number. There were about 30 present. However, when the delegation arrived to corporate headquarters in Vancouver, they were met by two reception staff who informed the group that the executive staff were off-site at a meeting. How convenient. In the events that followed, community supporters introduced themselves and intimated their support for the Burgerville Workers Union when they were interrupted by a flustered staffer that insisted that the delegation leave immediately. Despite her protests and the insistence that the delegation honor her request that they leave, introductions continued, drowning her out. Then Burgerville Worker Union members Lewis Brennan and Jordan Bandering delivered a speech and letter addressed to the executive staff. A staffer named John, whose role within the company was not clear, accepted the presentation of the reading of the letter along with a physical copy. It's unclear what the next step will be for the Burgerville Workers Union, but many expressed disappointment at the reception of the delegation and what it means for the relationship between corporate and its 1,500-strong workforce, who start off just making minimum wage. What also remains hazy is whether the rapport between Burgerville and the union will continue to stray from a positive or neutral disposition to a more antagonistic or adversarial one, as this encounter might suggest. What's clear is that a process of back and forth is just beginning to take shape, and that organizers and members of the Burgerville Workers Union will continue to hold out hope that their higher-ups will come willingly to the table to negotiate their demands. Tune in next week to hear more in-depth coverage of this story. It'll happen here on the evening news on Monday at 5 o'clock p.m. With KBOO News, I'm Kanan Schlesinger.
A recall petition has been filed against Steve Grasty, a Harney County commissioner who was critical of the 41-day takeover of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge by armed militants earlier this year. During the takeover, Grasty said Ammon Bundy and his supporters were not welcome in Harney County, and that many of his constituents were appalled that the Bundys purported to speak for the county's residents. Now some voters in Harney County want Grasty to step down from office. Kim Rollins of Burns submitted the paperwork to launch the recall drive, and petitioners say they gathered 566 signatures to force a recall election or compel Grasty's resignation. If Grasty refuses to resign, a recall election would be held within 35 days of the end of the resignation period. So far, Grasty, who has served three terms since entering office in 1999, has no plans to step down.
Members of the Audubon Society of Portland are holding a protest at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Office on Election Day to protest the killing of cormorants. This week, federal courts ruled that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has failed to address the primary cause of salmon decline on the Columbia and Snake River system, which is the operation of the hydroelectric dam system. Instead, the feds are shooting cormorants by the thousands. I spoke earlier this week with Audubon Society Director Bob Salinger about the protest, which is Tuesday, May 17th, from noon to 1 p.m. at Holiday Park. That's at Northeast Holiday Park and 11th Avenue near the Lloyd Center in Portland.
The federal government has slaughtered over 4,000 cormorants, which is a bird that eats fish, and they're literally out there killing as we speak. They're out there shooting them and deploying them. It's a very, very sad spectacle of federal agents using federal tax dollars out in the Columbia River estuary, killing literally thousands of birds while they ignore the primary cause of salmon decline. And so we're going to protest next week at the federal building across the street in Holiday Park, which is by the Lloyd Center, at 12 o'clock noon, and send a really strong message to the federal agencies, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, USDA Wildlife Services, that it's time to stop scapegoating birds. It's time to stop killing birds, and it's time to focus on the real problems, and that's the federal hydropower system.
Bob, can you give us a sense of an even bigger picture than this? Because you've discussed taxpayer money. We're looking at almost 2,500 adult cormorants and over 5,000 nests oiled last year. I'm reading from your release. What is the bigger picture? Are cormorants endangered?
Well, cormorants are actually declining. There are an order of magnitude less of them today than there were 100 years ago. There really aren't very many of them out there in the western United States. And East Sand Island is the largest cormorant colony, and that's at the Columbia River. What the federal agencies are intending to do is to kill 15% of the entire western population west of the Rocky Mountains. That's pretty incredible. That's killing at a scale that's almost unprecedented in modern times. To take out 15% of the population, pretty astounding. And they're doing it in the most horrific ways possible. They're out in boats right now, literally shooting into clouds of birds. And, you know, birds are crashing into the water, injured, dead. They're shooting them in the water. There's video now of them leaving the birds behind, struggling in the water. Really sick stuff. In the coming weeks, they're going to be shooting them off their active nests. They're literally going to go out at night with night vision goggles and high-powered rifles and shoot the birds while they're taking care of their eggs and their young. So really horrific stuff. Between this year and last year, they've already killed more than 4,000 birds. Their ultimate goal is over 11,000. And as I said earlier, the reality is this isn't what's causing salmon decline. It's the dams. And for the fifth time in 20 years, the courts have ruled that they're doing an insufficient job of addressing the dams. Interestingly, also, a couple of weeks ago, federal courts in the eastern United States ruled that the eastern U.S. cormorant killing program was illegal. What they found in the eastern United States was that the federal agencies have killed tens of thousands of birds unnecessarily, and were not able to demonstrate any benefits for fish in the eastern United States. So, you know, we now have agencies that are responsible for killing tens of thousands of birds in the east, over 4,000 birds in the west, for absolutely no reason. It's really sickening stuff.
Bob, who are those big players that are leading to this policy?
You know, these are big utilities, you know, energy companies, folks that use the hydropower system to provide energy. There's a big consortium of them out there. And, you know, you have federal agencies with terrible histories in terms of taking care of the environment, like the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, that are very beholden to these interests and have fought tooth and nail to avoid addressing the real issues. When you think about this, it's pretty incredible. The U.S. government has been sued 5 times in the last 20 years for not addressing salmon declines caused by the dams. And they have lost 5 times. Every single time they've been taken to court, they have lost. And yet they're out there frantically killing birds in the name of saving. We'd be looking at the
Tuesday
speaking, litigating it. Audubon will be there. Fund for Animals is show up, and, you know, the federal building is under the windows. Really have a show of force that people are fed up with this approach, don't accept it. We'll have banners, we'll have signs, we'll have chants. And, you know, it's just a way to reinforce that the public is paying attention, does care. We're also going to deliver a letter at that time to the regional director and the national director of the Fish and Wildlife Service, calling on them again to stop the slaughter. It's not the first time we've done this, but we want them to remember that we're out here, that people are paying attention and are going to hold them accountable.
Bob Salinger, Audubon Society, thanks for spending a few moments with us today.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving.
Delegates at the United Methodist Church World Conference in Portland rejected a procedural rule on yesterday that would have allowed contentious issues to be discussed in small groups. The proposal, known as Rule 44, was rejected by 57% of voting members. Rule 44 was proposed by LGBT supporters as a way to discuss potentially divisive issues, including welcoming LGBT people into the church. KBOO reporter Theo Burke was at the conference. He has more.
The procedural haggling over Rule 44 follows a week of dramatic buildup in the church over the issue of whether to include LGBT people. On Monday, 111 United Methodist ministers, local pastors, deacons, elders, and candidates for ministry openly came out as LGBT one day before the church's general conference started here at the Oregon Convention Center. The 111 came out by posting a letter to a website that immediately crashed due to overwhelming traffic. Back at the convention center, an openly gay couple served Holy Communion to willing delegates during a worship service at the conference. The United Methodist Church, the nation's second largest Protestant denomination, currently prohibits the ordination of, quote, self-avowed practicing homosexuals, end quote, and has struggled to deal with the issue of gay clergy and gay members. The 111 ministers now face a possible backlash under the existing United Methodist rules, which include trials and defrocking. The conference is in its fourth day of 10 days here in Portland and has no specific plans right now to vote on any resolution to change current church policies on LGBT members or the ordination of LGBTs. Any such possible legislation will be taken up on Tuesday at the earliest or later next week. The rejection of Rule 44 suggests a contentious tone for the rest of the conference. The gay minister's letter said, in part, "Our prayer is that you will remember the nameless ones around the world hungry for a word of hope and healing. LGBTQI people and their families exist in every church in every continent of this denomination." Their letter was moved to an alternative website and can now be viewed at believeoutloud.com. KABU will be at this conference on Saturday and all of next week, and will continue to report on this story. I'm Theo Burke for the KABU Evening News.
You are listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. This will be followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. For Portland's weather tonight, there's a 50% chance of thunderstorms with a low of 56. Showers continue tomorrow with a high of 65 for the day and a low of 54 tomorrow night. Today in history. In 1985, the Philadelphia Police Department dropped two bombs from a helicopter onto the Black Liberation Group MOVE's compound within a residential row tenement. John Africa, the leader of the MOVE organization, was killed in the bombing, along with six other adults and four children. MOVE was started in 1972 and engaged in public demonstrations against racism, police brutality, as well as preaching against technology. The explosion started an uncontrolled fire, which burned 53 houses and left 240 people homeless. This is also the situation that led to the incarceration of Mumia Abu-Jamal. The quote of the day is from Robert Anton Wilson, who said, "Humans live through their myths and only endure their realities."
Oregon sea star populations are just starting to make a comeback. Almost 90% died off in 2014. The latest research is optimistic. KABU's Jamie Haddad spoke to one scientist from Oregon State University. He's been tracking the species for the past few years.
Bruce Menge is a researcher at OSU in the Marine Biology Department. His team has been researching the sea star populations on the Pacific coastline. Bruce, thanks so much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
So I understand that in 2014, there was a huge die-off of the sea star population. What caused that?
The evidence from researchers at Cornell University is that it was caused by a virus. The factor that made that virus become more lethal, though, is still not clear.
I understand now that the sea star populations are slowly returning. Is this cause for celebration or not just yet?
Optimism, I guess, would be the way to refer to it. We're seeing huge numbers of baby sea stars the last 2 years, actually. last year a huge influx. This year, quite a few, not quite as many as last year. And it's really good. The numbers have increased a lot, but because most of the adults are gone, the total amount of sea stars on the shore in terms of biomass, unless you know where to look, you don't really know that the babies are there. The disease is still present in the populations that we've looked at, and we're seeing it more amongst the small ones, the babies, than we had seen in the past. So that's why I say guarded optimism.
Are there any theories as to how the sea star wasting disease came about?
Well, the evidence out of the Cornell researchers is that this virus is actually present in the environment. It's present in the animals, healthy animals as well as sick ones. It occurs in sediments. It occurs in the water column, and they found it in animals extending back to the 1940s. So it means that at least a strain of this virus has been around for a long time. Now, it's possible that there's been a mutation that has led to a more virulent strain, but whether that has occurred is still unclear. They're still doing research that will hopefully make that determination. But the question then is, was there a mutation? Or maybe there wasn't a mutation and something else in the environment has changed so that the conditions were such that the previously benign virus suddenly became lethal. There has been some evidence that temperature is involved. In Southern California and Washington, they observed that warm temperatures were associated with the onset of the disease. But here in Oregon, we saw the disease reach its height when waters were actually pretty cool because of upwelling. So it's clearly not a simple temperature story. And the other option, since it is a coastwide event, is that ocean acidification might be involved. Ocean acidification is going on. It is a coastwide event, and so that might also be involved. What combination of those factors might be important is still not yet clear.
How did the die-off impact the ecosystem on the coast?
Well, that's still something that's being revealed with time. So far, we've seen pretty major increases in the abundance of some species that are, in fact, eaten by the sea stars, by the purple star. Gooseneck barnacles, which have always been present, have pretty much blanketed the rocks at some of our study sites. So that could be a result of the absence of the adults. And the expectation is that in addition to those barnacles, mussels will become more abundant. It's a little early to be clear whether or not that's going to happen, but that's the expectation.
What are your hopes for this baby sea star population that's kind of in full swing right now?
Well, what I'm hoping is that the animals that are affected by the disease are a very small proportion of the population, and in fact, these small babies have a chance to grow up and basically replace the animals that were killed. And what I'm hoping is going to happen is that the babies are less susceptible to the disease overall and that they are able to grow up and mature and become reproductive adults and within a few years replace the animals that were killed.
Thank you so much, Bruce Menge from OSU.
Well, you're welcome.
For KBOO News, I'm Jamie Haddad.
Women could be required to sign up for the U.S. military draft starting in January 2018 if a bill known as the Draft America's Daughters Act is passed. The proposal requires women to register with the Selective Service, making both genders eligible for the draft during wartime. The Senate has approved the proposal, but a debate is expected when it's brought before the full Senate and House. In 2015, the Pentagon announced that all military roles, including ground combat, would be open to women. California Republican Representative Duncan Hunter opposes allowing women in combat and wrote the amendment to draft women as a protest to the Pentagon's decision. To Hunter's surprise, both Republicans and Democrats said women should be required to register for the draft and passed the amendment, even with Hunter voting against it. Currently, all American men are required to sign up for the Selective Service when they turn 18 and before they turn 26. Failure to sign up can result in men denied eligibility for federal student financial aid, federal job training, or federal employment, as well as cause difficulty in obtaining U.S. citizenship. The White House has not stated whether or not President Obama would sign the bill into law.
In Nevada, one of the sunniest states in the U.S., the rooftop solar industry that was thriving only a year ago is effectively dead. It was killed in a controversial decision by the Nevada Public Utilities Commission to strip away incentives for homeowners, making rooftop solar prohibitively expensive. Solar advocates are fighting back in the courts and the ballot box, but they face an uphill climb. FSRN's Larry Buell has more from Las Vegas.
Big rooftop solar companies say they just want energy choice for Nevadans. The truth is, their plan gives you no choice.
That's a commercial now airing in Nevada, paid for by a political action committee called Solar Energy Fairness. Multiple sources link the PAC's funding to NV Energy, the public utility that supplies much of Nevada with electricity. Solar advocates say the ads hammer extra nails in a coffin after the state's Public Utilities Commission decimated what was a burgeoning rooftop solar industry by slashing customer incentives back in December.
So they're trying to dividing the ratepayers.
Frank Rieger is founder and president of Las Vegas rooftop solar company, SolUp, one of the few remaining rooftop solar companies left in Nevada.
So they're saying the non-solar ratepayers are basically paying for the solar ratepayers, so subsidizing the solar system owners. Exactly the opposite is true. If there wasn't any solar anymore here in Nevada, then the utility could raise their rates by their discretion. They could do whatever they want. Solar is the only guarantee to these non-solar ratepayers that their prices remain stable.
In December, the Nevada PUC pointed to a cost shift study that alleges solar customers don't contribute enough to power grid maintenance, and they used this study to justify ending the practice of net metering. That's where solar customers bank credit for excess electricity that goes into the grid during the daytime and lets them pull out the same amount of energy after sundown, a kilowatt for kilowatt exchange. Solar customers that didn't generate enough electricity to cover their household needs would pay Nevada Energy for the difference. Net metering was a significant source of energy bill savings for customers like Judy Treichel. She and her husband invested nearly $9,000 after tax incentives for solar panels nearly 4 years ago. She says the most infuriating part of the PUC's decision is that it allows Nevada Energy to sell them energy they generated at a huge markup.
I don't think it's net metering when they're paying us a lower rate for what we produce in excess and they're charging us a higher rate for what we need to get back. I don't see that as being net.
Other independent studies have refuted some of the PUC's cost shift conclusions, stating that solar customers connected to the grid are paying their fair share. Some advocates say the fix was in on the solar industry when Nevada Energy was purchased by Warren Buffett's company, Berkshire Hathaway, in 2013 for $5.6 billion. Buffett is on the record saying owning a utility isn't a way to get rich. Solar advocates say that what Buffett could have added was, unless the utility is a monopoly and you control the revenue sources. In this case, the revenue source is solar. Scott Shaw is the director of research and commercial development for the Go Solar Installation Company in Las Vegas. He says an increase in solar customers reduced energy demand in the past few years and made the utility look for another revenue stream.
When you have a bunch of rooftop solar that is putting out solar during peak demand times, NV Energy will find it very difficult to justify building new generation stations or huge solar fields out in the desert and transmission to support it when they go to the PUCN to ask for all this money to do those things. That is where any utility around the country makes their most revenue, is building generation stations, facilities, and transmission lines.
Louise Helton is owner of One Sun Solar Electric in Las Vegas. She says the PR campaign is more about Nevada Energy wanting to control the solar industry rather than trying to kill it.
With just a very small footprint of big solar fields out in our desert, we could power the entire country. And if they can secure this, it will be low cost energy that they will be receiving because all of their raw energy will be coming from the sun, which is a free source that they will capture and then sell to everyone else.
But the main casualty in the war for control of solar has been the rooftop solar industry, which is dominated by small entrepreneurs. In 2015, the Solar Foundation reported over 8,000 jobs in solar in Nevada. The state ranked number one in solar jobs per capita in the U.S. 2016 will look very different. Battles over solar are heating up in other states. Though solar advocates recently preserved incentives in California, a struggle over residential solar incentives has started in neighboring Arizona. Nevada's remaining solar companies and allies are trying to put a measure to restore net metering on a ballot initiative. But if voters pass it in November, the solar industry and customers won't see any relief until next year at the earliest. They say the anti-solar PR campaign, shaming solar customers as energy freeloaders, is also making it harder to collect signatures for the initiative. There is one wild card, battery technology. Experts say the price of battery storage will become attractive for energy-generating households within the next year. With cheaper storage, solar users could disconnect from the grid completely. And in sunny Nevada, that might be what worries the energy utility most. Larry Buell, FSRN, Las Vegas.
Helping feed people who are hungry in Oregon will be as easy as putting canned food by the mailbox. Tomorrow is the 24th year of the Stamp Out Hunger Food Drive, when letter carriers in Oregon and across the country collect non-perishable foods from homes as they deliver mail. Food is collected and then distributed through Oregon Food Bank's network of partners to be distributed during the vital summer months. That's when demand to feed children who are out of school is great. Stamp Out Hunger is the largest single-day food drive in the country. The food collected in each town stays in that area to benefit those who need it.
Portland has lost one of its most fascinating and enigmatic artists. Writer, columnist, and boxing reporter Catherine Dunn died Wednesday at age 70. Dunn's work, from novels to radio and books, is part of what made Portland a cultural center of weirdness. She was a finalist for the National Book Award.